This is London Calling.
Andy Summers was the guitar player with The Police. He's also a photographer and a writer. In 2006, he wrote a biography called One Train Later. In 2012, it was turned into a documentary film and called Can't Stand Losing You, Surviving The Police. So I asked him, why did they change the title?
Because they're f***ers, that's why. You know, they're corporate f***ers, and they don't understand. You know, I had a super hip title, One Train Later, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they turn it into that because they think it's commercial and it's going to bring more people in because they don't know what they're talking about. So they undersell the project instead of, like, being true to it.
Yeah.
That's what you have to deal with, you know, it's just bullshit.
More from Andy Summers later. I'm Graham Mack, and here's what's going on in Britain. Well, the big news is we've fallen out with Russia. This is because an ex-Russian double agent has been poisoned in the town of Salisbury. Britain are saying Russia did it. Russia are saying they didn't. Theresa May, maybe you should just go over there and talk to Putin. Look out, though, if he offers you a cup of tea, just say no. Have you ever thought about how amazing trees are? I know you're going to think I've lost my mind, but I'm starting to get the feeling that spending time with trees might be the key to greatness. Percy Shaw is the man who invented cat's eyes, the reflectors you see at night in the road that must have saved countless lives. On YouTube, I watched a documentary about Percy from 1968. At one point, they show his factory in Halifax. Sticking out of a hole in the roof, you see the top branches of a tree. The factory was built around the tree. Alan Wicker's narration explains.
Sentimental as any no-nonsense Yorkshireman, he made sure when he was boss that the woodman spared the sycamore he climbed as a child.
Percy's sycamore is not the only tree that was important to historical pioneers. The orchard at Woolsthorpe Manor in Lincolnshire has a special apple tree. In 1666, an apple fell from it and made Isaac Newton ask the question, why do apples always fall straight down? That apple tree gave Newton the inspiration for his work and helped him become one of the most influential scientists of all time. Without Newton's work on gravity and his laws of motion, we'd never have been able to fly to the moon. And Newton's apple tree is not the only tree that plays a part in man's conquest of space. Robert Goddard was an American engineer, professor, physicist, and inventor. He built the world's first liquid-fueled rocket. With his team, he launched 34 rockets between 1926 and 1941. NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center is named after him. He grew up in Boston, and at the age of 17, on October the 19th, 1899, he climbed a cherry tree. He was transfixed by the sky. Later he wrote, on this day I climbed a tall cherry tree at the back of the barn, and as I looked towards the fields at the east, I imagined how wonderful it would be to make some device which had the possibility of ascending to Mars. For the rest of his life, Goddard called October the 19th, Anniversary Day. He moved his rocket testing equipment to New Mexico and would go back to Boston and visit the cherry tree. He wrote about it in his journal. October the 19th, 1927. Got rocket weighed and ready in the afternoon. Stopped at cherry tree at 6 p.m. October the 19th, 1928. Took out trailer to the farm with sacks. Went out to cherry tree. October the 19th, 1932. Worked on flow patterns in the afternoon. Went to cherry tree. Anniversary day. In the autumn of 1938, Goddard got a letter from a friend in Massachusetts telling him that the cherry tree had been uprooted in a nor'easter. In his journal that night, he wrote, "Cherry tree down. Have to carry on alone." Percy Shaw, Newton, and Goddard's connection to trees got me thinking about how important trees might be. Buddha reached enlightenment as he sat and meditated under a tree. Why do we decorate a tree at Christmas? Do trees have a connection to the universe? They're directly connected to the earth through their roots. They interact with the atmosphere through their branches, and their leaves absorb energy from the sun that's travelled millions of miles through space. Do trees communicate with the universe? If you spend time with them, is inspiration one of their fruits? Does spending time with trees bring good luck? Well, it would explain why we say, knock on wood. Finding someone to share an apartment or a house with is always a tricky thing. Well, there's a company in Switzerland now that will do a DNA test to see if the potential housemate is compatible with you. Got me thinking about housemates from hell. Badger.
I was living with a partner, and she was, well, she was a fanatical cleaner and things like that, which was a bit of a nightmare. But I mean, one time I was eating my food, and I put my knife and fork down, and I was just leaning across. I think I was grabbing a newspaper or something. By the time I'd come back, she'd taken the plate out to the kitchen and was cleaning it. I'd never finished eating. Right? But she kept using all these kitchen rolls to clean. I said, get some of those dishcloth things, yeah? So we was in the supermarket. We bought a pack of 15 dishcloths, and that. A couple of days later, she said, oh, I'm going to need some more of those dishcloths. I thought, well, she was just wiping soap once and throwing it in the bin.
Right. Yeah.
And then she said to me, look at the freezer. She said, I've saved a load of space. She said, see all those frozen meals? Look, I've got the whole lot in there because I took them out of the packaging, and they fit a lot better if you haven't got the packaging. I said, yeah, you're right, they do fit a lot better. I picked up a meal at random. I said, what is it, and how long does it take to cook?
So you had no information at all on what was in there, nothing?
I didn't even see it because it was frozen. I said, what is it, and how long does it take to cook? Yeah, all right, bye.
How did we end up with so much junk? That's the question I found myself asking as we start getting rid of the stuff that's not coming with us when we move. It turns out the answer to that question is really simple, and so is the solution to the problem. There's also a lesson here to be learned about radio programming. The problem is there's only a finite amount of space. As you accumulate more stuff, that doesn't change. It's the same with a formatted radio hour. There are only 60 minutes in each hour. I've tried to explain this to program directors over the years, and some of them have a hard time grasping the concept of the 60-minute hour. When they ask for a new feature to be added, I always ask them, well, what do you want me to take out? Well, this usually produces a confused look from them. Some have actually said to me, I don't want you to take anything out. I've had radio programmers get angry and behave as if I've personally insulted them. If I've dropped a playlist feature because I've added a piece of compelling content like a really good caller into that hour, usually a caller that the programmer has said they enjoyed. Some have even suggested that I should move that caller to a different part of the hour, as if the act of moving it magically creates more minutes in that hour. In this universe, time and space don't expand to make room for what we want to put in them. When you add something, you have to ask yourself, what am I going to throw out? When we bought our new computer, we didn't get rid of the old one. It just went in the back of a cupboard. Same thing happens with clothes, shoes, books, you name it. Well, from now on, When something comes in, something else has to go. It's one in, one out. Homes are like radio shows. If you just keep adding stuff without throwing anything out, you end up with clutter. The legendary British comedian Ken Dodd has died. He was known as Doddy, and he was 90 years old. What do you think about this sad news, Roxanne?
I hate to say it, but until today, I didn't actually know who Ken Dodd was.
How old are you?
You must think I'm in...
No, how old are you?
27.
27?
27.
You didn't know who Ken Dodd was?
No, no. I knew I'd heard the name, but I've never seen anything with him in it. Never heard his songs, nothing like that. So.
Okay, well, you know, shows that
probably
Ken...
a bit before my time.
Well, yeah, his heyday was probably the '70s, maybe the '80s, but he was going in the '60s. His career went all the way, pretty much from like music hall through the northern clubs, all the way up to the Royal Variety Performance. He's as far as comedy, his act is not for everyone though. To be unfair, it was an old style act, but it was a vintage act. Actually, it was a vintage act more than an old act. I'll give you a joke that I'm sure Ken Dodd would appreciate you using now that he's died. Okay?
All right.
When someone, you say to someone, just say to him, Ken Dodd died. And if they go, did he? Go, no, Doddy. Okay?
Okay.
There's a free one from me.
I think I'll try that one on my mum.
Okay, well, try it on me now. See if you can do it.
Oh, okay. Oh, I've forgotten already.
You've got to start with Ken Dodd died. So, okay, here we go. I'm your mum. Hey, Roxanne, how are you? What's new?
Ken Dodd died.
Did he?
No, Doddy.
What a beautiful building this is. You know, I always feel at home in theatres like this, because we're about the same age. Are there any old farmers in tonight? Any farmers in?
Yes!
I thought so. You can always tell when there's farmers, you know, when they're showing their wives to their seats and say, come on, lazy girl, come on, lazy girl. Come on. They had wonderful songs in the old music hall, Jim. Wonderful. These are real wonderful songs, like When Banana Skins Are Falling, I'll Come Sliding Back to You. Honestly, that was a real song. How does a hen know the size of an egg cup when it lays an egg? Real song. I've never wronged an onion, so why does it make me cry?
Jim from Philadelphia is on Skype. Hey, Jim, you would have enjoyed the show I went to see yesterday at the National Theatre in London. Network. Remember the old film Network with Peter Finch? I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. Oh, Bryan Cranston was just fantastic in that role. It was just amazing. On the South Bank there, it was a present for Julie, trip to the theatre, but one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Oh, is that right?
Wow, what a show. Just fantastic. I mean... it's part play, part live movie, because there's like four cameras following him around all the time. And like, you know, you see him walk out onto the stage, go to the news desk, gets all his makeup done and everything. And then he presents a news bulletin to camera and it's on the screen at the back. And at one stage, two of the actors are outside and you're like, hey, hang on, that is outside. There's the Thames and that's what the weather's like. That's live. And then the next minute they walk into the theater, the conversation doesn't end because they take them like that. They go into the theater and then down the corridor and then they walk out onto the stage and it isn't cut. It's not a cheat. It was live. It's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal. And Cranston doing that whole speech. The news is bullshit. Go to your windows. Shout, I can't take it. I'm as mad as hell. I can't take it anymore. And then when they start rating and they give him his own kind of chat show, the audience in the theater become the audience of the TV chat show. You got a warm up man comes out and then Cranston is then doing the show to the audience then, as if you're the TV audience of this show. And at one stage, Cranston ends up sitting in the audience, and it's just phenomenal. There's even like, there's, if you paid an extra 30 quid and went into a lottery, you could actually, we didn't do it, but you could, be in that, there's a restaurant on the side of the stage. You could be in the restaurant, you get a 5-course meal. and they act out scenes, some scenes of it at the tables. But of course, but they've got these cameras following them around, so it's all on the big screen as well. So even if you can't see it in that corner of the stage, you're still getting it. It's just out of this world. It's one of the best things I've ever seen. It's that good. If that goes on tour, if they do it outside London, go and see it. Network. And I can't think of another actor that could have pulled off the Howard Beale part, the Peter Finch part, other than Cranston. He was just spot on, beyond perfect. It was just excellent. It's just great. So I can't recommend it enough. It's on, I don't know how long it's on for now, but I mean, when I booked the tickets in September, the earliest ticket I could get was March. So it just shows you how
quick it's filling up.
I mean, there are a few seats come available every day, and they reckon people, I think they go on sale at 9 every morning, and there are people queuing up from 6. There are people standing in line at 6 a.m. with no guarantee of getting a ticket. It's out. It's beyond good. It's just sensational. Just loved it. And of course, he's got the audience, you know, he's got everybody shouting, "I'm as mad as hell and I can't take it anymore." Everyone, the audience is shouting it, you know, it's just great, you know. And then at the very, very end,
it sounds like it's more of an event than it is a theater than a show.
Yeah, but it is a play too. There's a story, and you know, and then, you know, there's TV execs, and there's the whole story of the media business and fake news, and it's more relevant now than it was in the 70s, even though it's set in the 70s. But it's just great. It's just, if you get the chance, it's just so good. It's so good. It's a real 21st century experience. But it is, and when it's all boiled down, it is a play. It's a dramatic play. But, loved it. Loved it. Can't speak highly enough of it. Forgot what I was going to say something about it with everybody shouting out. I'm as mad as, I can't remember now, but,
sounds like a good evening out.
Yeah, well, we went to matinee, 2:00. Perfect. Oh. 2:00 in the afternoon. Perfect. So we're done by 4, you know. Yeah, you know, make a leisurely trip back home, you know. Fine.
Home in time for dinner.
Well, we were home for 5, you know.
Yeah.
No big deal. It's great, you know. And then with the hours I work, 2:00 is just a great time to go. And there are a couple of famous people there as well in the crowd.
Because then if you go to an 8:00 show, if you go to an evening show, you're not getting home until 2300.
Yeah. Yeah, and you don't, you know, you can't do that in the week. It was just really, really good. And you could see there were some references in it that they stuck in, like he's talking about the Arabs, and then he went, "And the Russians," and he paused, you know, because we've got this whole poisoning case here. And you could see, and everybody cheered when he said, "And the, you can't," because he's like, "You can't trust the Arabs and you can't trust the Russians," and he paused knowing, and everybody's cheering. And then, at the very end, when the show's finished, after they've done the bow and everything. And what was great was all the technical staff, all the technicians and the camera people and everything, they also took a bow because they were part of the show.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And all the music's performed live, all the stings and that for the like news intros, for the news bulletins and everything. There's like 4 musicians at the very top. You can see them performing it all live. But there's electronic type newsy music and these beds that go under the music, under the stories and, you know, on the promos and stuff. It's just great. And then when they cut to ads, it's all 70s ads come up, American 70s ads. and so it actually, I think it would work better in America because there'd be that nostalgia value. People would remember the old commercials.
Yeah.
But at the very end, they showed this montage of presidential inaugurations. Not sure how far back they went. Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, you know, I swear, you know, that Washington, the inauguration of them swearing the oath to the office. And it gets to, it goes right through and it gets to Obama. And then Trump comes on the screen and you can't even hear it because the booing is so loud. In London.
That's great.
Just great. Just great. Just everything about it. Just great. If it comes to Broadway, you gotta go.
Yeah.
You gotta go. And if you hear about it, book those tickets. I was lucky. I heard Cranston being interviewed on the Nerdist podcast. And he was being interviewed about his book. He's got a book out, which sounds pretty good. Actually, they were selling the book in the shop. They own all the books in the shop at the theater. They're all signed. He signed them all. I should have got one, but I didn't. Anyway, his autobiography is called Bryan Cranston, My Life in Parts. And he was talking about...
Title?
Yeah. And he was talking about that on the Nerdist podcast. And he just happened to drop in. I'm off to London to play. And I'm like, I was hearing it. I was thinking, and it was just before Julie's birthday. It was in September. And that's when I thought, I'll get him. And so I heard about it by accident in September. And then the only tickets were available were in March. I mean, that's what a hit it is. It's just.
Yeah. Wow. It's
just phenomenally good. Phenomenally good. If you get the chance, don't know. It must go elsewhere. They can't leave it just in London. Surely not.
Yeah, especially with Bryan Cranston.
Yeah. Yeah. And really don't know anyone else that could pull it off. I might be wrong. But a lot of the old guard, like Dustin Hoffman and people like that, who could do it, they're too old now. They need to be a certain age. They need to be like, you know, 50s. And Cranston's right in the pocket. I mean, just perfect. I don't know. I really don't know who else could have pulled it off. It's just terrific.
Yeah, it's got to be old enough to pull off the old guard
news anchor. Yeah, who's jaded? Who's just had enough?
But young enough to pull off the energy.
Yeah, yeah. The energy is
times a week.
Energy is incredible. And some of the monologues that he does are just great. And it was a great device that because the news was rating, they gave him his own kind of chat show. And then the stage became the statue. Well, you know, the warm up guy comes out, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Where are you from tonight? Where are you from? And he's talking to, you know, he's doing all the warm up and he's going, then when the applause light comes on, here's the applause light. Here is your host, Howard Beale. And everyone's cheering and he comes out and he's like, ladies and gentlemen, you are being lied to. And away he goes, you know, he's just, and the great bit in that part of the show, he goes into the audience and he sits with someone and he says, hi, how you doing tonight? And they said, excellent. And you know, whatever. And he says, do I detect an English accent there? And the guy goes, yeah. He goes, well, thanks for coming all the way from London to New York to see this show tonight. Right. Here's what we're going to, it's just, you know, little in jokes in there. It's just lovely. Lovely. Cranston, outstanding, just outstanding. Really weird at one point when he first does the news anchor piece. He's on the desk, and the desk is sort of, it's not pointed to the side, and it's not pointed at the audience. It's pointed at kind of a 45-degree angle. So, and they've got the camera pointed directly on him doing the news anchor solo, you know, from the waist up, yeah. Shot. And you're watching the screen at the back of the stage and you're watching him on the stage, and there's some magic there because you see him just doing it. But then when you look at him on the screen and you see, wow, he's really working that camera. That is he's doing something with his eyes or something, because there's more coming out there than what you can see him doing. You can only see it on the screen. Obviously, we were further away, so I don't know if you were closer up, you would have caught it. But that phrase that they say, oh, the camera loves him, it really does. Cranston knows how to make that thing for the screen. He knows how to make that work. But that more like the second. And I'd say another great thing they did as well. No interval. I've been to shows in London before and they have the interval and it just kills it. And then they almost have to bring it back. But this just did 2 hours straight. straight 2 hours. It didn't feel like 2 hours, but it was 2 hours.
Yeah.
Bang.
Yeah.
No interval. Just keep going. They should just do that with all shows. Bloody interval. So they're going to sell a few more programs and shit, you know? Just keep it going. Yeah. That was great.
Yes, they'll sell one more drink a person or yeah. every other person.
Yeah. Really. And if you can't go 2 hours without a drink, maybe you shouldn't be at the theater. Maybe you should be at a meeting.
We call it football. You call it soccer. It got political this week in the world of sport. Because of the current political standoff between Britain and Russia, the England football team may boycott the World Cup in Russia. Experts say if this happens, the chances of them winning the tournament will be about the same as if they play. Hey, talking of Russia, how's this plane that took off from a Russian airport, a hatch opened, and millions of dollars worth of gold fell out? Most of it ended up on the tarmac at the airport, but some of it went into people's backyards. Imagine that windfall. What's your windfall story, Joe?
Bit of a strange one. My old fella, he emigrated to Adelaide, Australia.
Yeah.
And sadly, he passed away back in 2004.
Mm.
And as you know, because you've been there, the Aussies are a bit strange, so they like to do things a bit differently. So we had a funeral on a golf course, which is a bit random.
Yeah.
And then we had the wake in the first pub that they ever drank in.
Right.
So we sort of celebrate their first sort of time there. Now, my old boy, he liked to have a little bit of a gamble, and so he used to have a go on the keno, which you'll know.
Yeah, it's like super fast bingo, isn't it? Yeah.
Every 5 minutes,
yeah.
And you can go and, you know, get his paper, do the keno in the newsagent.
Yeah.
He'd have a little bit on the ponies, the old trotty things.
Yeah.
And he used to like go on the pokies.
Right, yeah, the bandits, yeah.
Yeah, the old bandits. So I said, well, that's what I'll do on the day of the funeral. I'll have a keno, one bet on a horse, and I'll have the equivalent of 20 quid on the one-armed bandit.
Right.
And so I did that. So I duly got me dollars, placed the old bet on maximum, pressed the automatic, and let it spin through. Well, then a win thing comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I couldn't work it out. Not our machines, just clicking numbers. And one of my brothers came over, who he'd been living over there with me dad, and he's like, how much did you bet? So, well, I don't know. Did you know how much you've won? I was like, no, I don't know. Well, when it finished, it worked out at over $1,300.
Goodness me! So about 700 quid?
Yeah, well, it was even better exchange rate.
Oh, right, yeah, a little while ago. Yeah, back then, yeah, it was even better then. Yeah, so...
Yeah.
So close to £1,000. Wow! That is a bit cosmic, isn't it?
That was, and of course, everyone was going, your dad's watching you there, boy.
What's your windfall story, Karen?
I was out walking my dog with my husband just through a random field, as you do.
Uh-huh.
And we both spotted something on the ground thinking, oh, that looks like a 20. Picked it up, it was all folded up, and when we opened it, it was 70.
It was £70 in cash?
Yeah, in cash.
Now, that's highly suspicious how that got there, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, just a field.
So did you report it or pocket it?
Well, there was no one around.
No,
yeah.
No.
We were on our own.
Wow, and have you been back to that field since?
I don't think we have.
I'd be back there every day.
Well, yeah, it was one we used to walk through, like if we were going to a pub, but we haven't been to that pub for a little while yet.
Wow, 70 quid, you just... Yeah. Karen, thank you so much.
Okay.
Cheers. Ah, we lost Professor Stephen Hawking recently. And Martin, you got to meet the great man briefly. You work in the film industry. What happened?
I did a job at a Go Compare commercial, and it was a theory of the black hole, and I went to the maths college up at Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And they had mathematicians do an equation for 2 days on this blackboard, this great big blackboard with this equation on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an audience there, and he was on the stage.
Who's Stephen Hawking? Professor Stephen Hawking, yeah?
Yeah, he was on the stage, and they just wanted an altar lamp to shine down on him.
Yeah.
They asked me to bring a stepladder in, so yeah. I brought a stepladder in. The electrician went up the stepladder and shone the light on the, turned the light on to him. And I'm looking at the blackboard, this equation, just for a joke. I thought I'd say, the answer's wrong. And so I've gone, no, that's the wrong answer on there. And someone in the audience, one of the mathematicians, has gone, he's right, that's the wrong answer. And then Stephen Hawking so what's turned out to just be me being a... having a practical joke turned out to be true.
Professor Stephen Hawking, this fella's wasted holding ladders.
Yeah, I don't know what he thought, but yeah, they've just gone, how do you know? I said, well, I just looked at it and thought that's the wrong answer. Just worked. Yeah, no, I played up to it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Martin.
That's all right.
This school kid from Newcastle upon Tyne goes on a trip with the school to London, gets left behind at King's Cross Station. What's your left behind story, Joe?
I was once left behind on a fire station.
What?
So, many years ago, I used to be in the fire brigade.
Right.
Back when it was the fire brigade.
Yes.
And I shan't say names of places to protect the innocent, in the old days, we were allowed to sleep. They called it rest boots off over a night shift.
Right.
So when you got a fire call, the bells went down, you heard a noise, all the lights went on.
Yeah.
Everybody turned out to the bays where the fire engine was, you got a print out, and off you went to the job. I used to sleep in a dormitory that was right beside the bays, you know, a long time before health and safety.
Mm-hmm.
And one night I woke up to find myself alone and in darkness, no fire engines, no crew.
They'd all gone out on a call and you'd slept through the alarm and everything.
Yeah.
Like, was the disciplinary action? Because you were literally sleeping on the job.
I was literally sleeping on the job. Fortunately, when they got back, my governor, you know, read the riot act to me. But it was an investigation. He was just going out to check out a fire alarm. And he couldn't be bothered to wait, so he went, sorry, we'll go in.
Let's get to my main guest. It's Andy Summers. You'll know him as the guitar player with the Police. He's on the phone from the coast of Southern California, where I bet the weather's a damn sight better than it's been here lately. We've had snow in London.
Well, we're lucky today. Yeah, actually, it's a beautiful, perfect Californian day. It's been a bit cold lately, but... the sun is out, the sky is blue, it's lovely, but they do say, I think that on Wednesday we're going to have rain here that they haven't seen in like 100 years or something.
Wow.
Like, scary, which is kind of horrible because, you know, just up the road here we had all those slides in Santa Barbara, which was kind of tragic. Yeah.
Because you're in Santa Monica, right, by the coast?
Oh, in Santa Monica, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me about the new tour and this new show. Sounds exciting.
Yes, well, I guess this has been a long time coming, sort of in the head, you know, but, you know, how life goes, it's just, I can't get around to it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play solo guitar, sort of, and some of it I'll do with backing tracks, but to projected photography. So I'll have these various streams of photography playing, you know, basically images, black and white images dissolving, you know, one to another on a screen. Most of it's very exotic, shot in Asia, like China and Tibet, places like that, by me, obviously,
mm-hmm.
is the whole point of it. But I've never done this before, but I think I'm fairly well known now that I do a lot of photography as well as, you know, being a musician. And we tried this out about a year ago at the Grammy Museum in LA, and it went down a complete storm. And that was, I think, when the light went on, like, okay, I should do this properly, you know, because we threw that together in about 3 days. So it's been a phenomenal amount of work to pull all this together. But with the miraculous aid of, you know, what you can do now with computers, I've kind of got every picture I ever shot up on the computer screen. It's sort of amazing. So we've put together a bunch of sequences, but that's what it is. It's really playing guitar to to the pictures, some solo, some with backing tracks. Then I'm going to probably do a Q&A with the audience, and I'm going to read some stories that I've written that are fairly dark comic tales, usually involving a guitar one way or the other. And it's kind of, that's it. I'm doing it about a week from today, so we'll see what happens. Yeah, I'm going to do it. I mean, I'm sort of regarding it a little bit as a trial run to see how it goes. And obviously, probably after the first show, I'll probably immediately make adjustments.
And it's called Harmonics of the Night. Where does the title come from?
I have no idea. It's something that came to me somewhere. You know, they come from various places. Sometimes I just make them up on the spot, or I'm writing and something comes to me. I write them down. You know, I have a whole list of titles for things that, you know, I can use in an emergency, pages of them. So it was probably in there somewhere, and I thought it was sort of appropriate for this. Where we really want to aim this, and we're going to find this, is sort of shape the venues more to what I'm doing, because this is really more like a fine art show. It's kind of, you know, super cool guitar playing and great sounds and all that, but it's not a rock show at all. It's not the Police.
Yeah.
I think the initial mistake was, you can do like a Police show. No. Let's take a step back. No, it's not that at all. It's something very different. And there are a few people who specialize in, you know, like museum gigs, art spaces, that kind of thing. So, you know, we've got this going, and, you know, for instance, the first show is at the Musical Instrument in Phoenix, which is a wonderful place, and has got a fantastic theater, beautiful theater. We're going to film it there, so that would, it's going to be very good to film it, because that will give us a promo device, I suppose.
Yeah.
Then we got more of it. We got playing a very old Art Deco theater in LA, which should be good.
Yeah.
Bit nervous about that. Then we got the Fine Arts, Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco, which coincidentally is an unusual situation, because the night before I open a photography show at the Leica Gallery, which is a beautiful space in central San Francisco called The Bones of Chuangzu, which is the title of a book I have coming out hopefully this spring if the guy gets it out in time. And then the next night, I play the show with all the streaming photography in a theater. So I don't think there are many people that could do that.
Yeah.
I think I'm probably unique.
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping that that gets some attention that it, I think it deserves. And it is a one-off. So those are the three first shows. I've got another one in two more in New York in July. Again, kind of a hardcore art scene on Long Island, and I think it's called the Guildhall in Sag Harbor. It's a guitar weekend with some great artists.
Yeah.
You know, guitarists.
Yeah.
Playing out like Richard Thompson and Badji Assad and G. Smith and me opening the whole thing. That's going to be great. So I think these are, you know, it's taken me a long time to get to this place. It's a phenomenal amount of work in terms of downloading the photography and, into the right selection. And I start like a week from today, and we're still putting it together. This phone call, I'm rushing off to the studio.
You've got this parallel career as a photographer. You've done books and more than 40 shows. Does being a musician help as a photographer?
Yeah, totally. It really does. And, you know, I think one of the interesting observations is how do you relate the two? Well, I mean, they are relatable. You know, I mean, it's obviously photography is a different media. But, I mean, in very simple terms, you have a sensibility. Just like in music, and you know, over the years, you know, hopefully your sensibility gets refined. And it becomes more sophisticated, and you actually get better at it. Also, same thing in music as in photography. And of course, I had many years of practicing as a musician before I really got involved with the camera. And, you know, certainly in terms of being in the moment, improvising, having to have rapid reactions in the moment. In that case, you know, of course, the camera took over. You know, photography, you know, you're using a camera instead of the guitar, but I'm reacting to what's in front of me.
Yeah.
Just as in a band, I might be listening to what the drummer's doing, and I would, you know, cut my playing to go with whatever he's doing, maybe, or I lead him. You know, this is deep stuff, you know, which you spend a lifetime working on, but there is a compatibility. I think you get a set of information from music through your training, and you can bring it over to photography.
Yeah.
And I think you're always looking for the condition of music, even in photography. This is what you're looking for. I guess I do. If I'm reading a book, I'm into writing, I'm looking for something. I realize this now that it's kind of musical to me. You know, I can put up, you know, read or put down a book according to the musicality of the language, I think. That's what I grow up, that's my natural talent is for music, and doesn't mean to say you can't bring that to other areas, but I think that things are fairly intertwined, you know.
There's definitely a crossover with it. It's a science and an art at the same time, because there's a lot of mathematics in music, and you know, the light and the shade of photography. It's all about, you know,
Well, you know, you have an ear, you know, you have a natural talent. I definitely have it for music. I have perfect time. I have an ear. I'm born with it. And I think we've proved that in the career. Photography, hopefully you'll have a natural eye, you know, and you will have a thing for it, and you start to recognize things. I seem to have, you know, I've worked at it, you know, like just anything else. You work at it, you train your eye, and then you find your way with it. And partly you do that by, you know, I mean, I think we used to call this, you know, procedure by negation, if you like. So it's like, these are all things I don't like, so I'm not doing any of that. Yeah. What am I left with?
Yeah.
Only this.
Yeah.
All right, this is my thing, because I can't stand everything else. And this is how you go forward.
Yeah.
So you limit your framework, and once you do that, then you start to get somewhere. And out of that tight framework, hopefully it'll make some art.
Yeah. And the current album, which I'm sure you'll be showcasing in the shows, is your 14th solo album, Triboluminescence. What does the title mean? And did I say it right
as well? Well, you did. And I have to congratulate you on that, because the last guy was German. He couldn't say it. I thought it was a really cool word and a great title, and I think I also slightly shot myself in the foot with it, because most people can't spell it or say it.
Yeah.
And I've actually spelled it wrong a couple of times myself. I mean, the previous album was called Metal Dog. I should probably have called it something a bit more simple like that. But actually what it means is I thought of it as a metaphor. If you look it up, it's a science word that means striking something to create light in the dark. I thought that was a lovely, apt metaphor for making.
Oh, creating light from dark, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You like one-word titles, don't you?
Do I? Have I used a lot? Yeah, well, let's think about that.
You seem to, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the magic formula is usually one or three.
Okay, yeah. Same as comedy.
Yeah.
There's probably a lifetime of influences in there, but are there any specific musical places you went to for inspiration on the Triboluminescence album?
Yeah, I mean, the little sort of mini history to this, and, you know, the previous album I made was Metal Dog. And now, you know, prior to Metal Dog, I made many albums. I made an album of Mingus. I made Monk. I made a lot of records of all my own compositions, collaborations with other people, a lot of stuff. This process. And I guess I'm going to make a third one to, you know, I like suddenly, oh, yeah, it's a trilogy. Right. Oh, that's a good word, trilogy. Let's do a third one. And then we're through this phase, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's all completely anal, but whatever. Yeah, Metal Dog started out because I was going to work with a visual artist in New York for a dance company, and we were preparing, like, music and visuals for a very well famous choreographer in New York. It hasn't come to pass yet. I mean, we're sort of halfway through it. And I'd got a lot farther along with the music. But I was writing this music for Metal Dog for dancers. I wasn't thinking, oh, you know, record, guitar solos, all that. I was thinking a little differently. I was imagining dancers on a stage, you know, like modern dance. And then the other guy didn't really come through enough. So I thought, well, I don't want to waste all this energy and all that. But I was into this very sonic music. So in other words, I wasn't going in prepared, like, okay, here's the whole structure. It's all written out. This is the way it goes. Let's get some guys to play it. I was starting from purely sonic sounds that I would create in the studio through various pedals and devices with the electric guitar to get something very fresh. And I thought it was much more cutting edge and experimental. And then from that point, I would try and develop it into, you know, a track or a
fully realized composition, but at some point I realized no one's going to dance to this at this point, so I'll turn it into an album, and that was Metal Dog. And then so Tribal Luminescence is in fact this sort of sequel to that, and trying to kind of up the ante. And there's a lot of, as you were asking, like influences like Southeast Asian music, Balinese music, Indian music, African in there, to give it a sort of a more exotic flavor than just straight ahead jazz.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like in a more traditional jazz setting, like you'd have a pianist probably, you know, playing the harmonies and so over. In this case, I put these sort of exotic guitar loops as a replacement, and I changed the drumming up more into like hip hop drumming and stuff like that. So there are a lot of musical moves to try and achieve this sort of contemporary sound of it.
And are you an experimental musician who just happens to have been in one of the biggest bands in the world? Is that how this happened, you think?
I think that's true, actually. I think that's totally true. I mean, before I was in the Police, I was in the Soft Machine. I was, you know, I went to college. I studied music properly at college.
In California, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but my thing was really classical music. I loved Messiaen, 20th century music, Bartok, Webern, all of that. I was pretty educated. I happened to be a guitar player. I was fairly steeped in a lot of 20th century classical music and, you know, sort of outer edge music. So in a way, you know, I didn't do a lot of it in public, but I definitely had that sensibility going, was very aware of it. And I think, in a way, coming back to this approach more than sort of, I never really liked to play straight ahead. Well, I do, actually. It's great if you're a player to play bebop, you know, because we all train to play that and try and play it very well, but I don't really want to do much of that in public. So you come to this particular musical space, which in a way is where I started years ago. And I made those two records with Robert Fripp.
Yeah.
In the mid 80s that were very successful and were sort of ahead of their time. And they were copied by so many people that you can see that the sensibility was already there. You know, I was doing it years ago, and of course I subsequently made a lot of records on my own that explore this more. But I feel with these last two records, I'm pushing more to that edge.
Yeah.
You know, not going, listen to less. Well, I mean, there's some great guitar solos on these records, but not necessarily listen to this fantastic shredding on this record. You know, it's as much about as the attitude, the composition. Of course, there are improvised solos, but, you know, what I'm pushing towards is a sensibility that's unique and doesn't really sound like anybody else. You know.
Yeah. And you play all of the instruments on the album apart from cello. Why was it so important to bring in an expert? And if you're not up to it on the cello, why did you even use a cello in these days of sampling?
Yeah, I know. Some people I'm sort of pissed off that I did it because, that's a record that's still going with a guy called Artyom Manukyan. He's Armenian. He's a wonderful he's sort of a jazz cellist, really. He doesn't really play classical. He's a fabulous player.
Yeah.
We've made a lot of tracks. We haven't quite finished the album, but I had all these tracks sitting around, and I just took one and put it on this record. And I sort of feel like everybody goes, well, you played everything except the one cello track. Everybody picks up on that. Go, oh, fuck off. Yeah, so what? I wrote the f***ing song. I told him what to play. Excuse me.
Yeah.
I gave him a credit. You know.
Yeah.
But we're going to continue. He's just contacted me because he wants to finish the record. And there may be a project there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just time to get all this in. You know, I got to do one with him, another with a great keyboard player. There's a girl I'd like to play with. I mean, anyway.
Yeah. And since the first solo album in 87, all of the others have been instrumentals, even though you are a singer. I mean, you sang lead vocals with the Police on Be My Girl, Sally, Friends, Mother, Someone to Talk
to. Yeah, I mean, I've thought about that. I mean, you know, I think I did one vocal record. And
it's the first one, I think.
Yeah, for XYZ, yeah, after the Police. I got sort of slagged off for it.
Yeah?
And it put me right off.
Are you more vulnerable when you put vocals out there then, you think?
Yeah, I was very vulnerable, and my feelings were hurt, and I went, I'm not doing that again. And I didn't.
Really? And you've been gun-shy ever since?
Yeah. So I was like, why don't you sing more? You know,
I don't think I have a natural great singing voice. That's a God-given gift, you know, and I certainly believe that it's innate. People say, oh, yeah, anyone can learn to sing. No. It's a point with singing. You've got it or you haven't got it. You know, if the instrument isn't built into your physicality, you're never going to get it.
I don't know. I wonder if it's a confidence thing, you know, because
I don't lack confidence.
Okay, because so many singers didn't believe they had a great voice. I mean, people like, you know, John Lennon never thought that he had a great voice. And I just wonder if it's just an insecurity. That's the insecurity of being an artist. I don't know.
Well, I think you have to be, as an artist, I think that the two things you have to be is very tough and very vulnerable.
Yeah.
It's the vulnerability that allows for the creativity. Without that, you're not going to do anything. If you're like this hard shell, how's anything creative ever going to happen?
Yeah.
So you're like a walking wound, and at the same time, you know, you have to sort of learn to protect yourself, but keep that part alive.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Yeah. Biography, One Train Later, 2006, voted Music Book of the Year by Mojo. It was turned into the documentary film Can't Stand Losing You, Surviving the Police. Why did they change the title?
Yeah, I don't know, because they're f***ers, that's why. You know, they're corporate f***ers, and they don't understand. You know, I had a super hip title, One Train Later, great.
Yeah.
You know, they turn it into that because they think it's commercial and it's going to bring more people in because they don't know what they're talking about. So they undersell the project instead of, like, being true to it.
Yeah.
That's what you have to deal with, you know, it's just bullshit. You know, yeah. And I fought that, believe me.
Oh, right, but you lost that one.
Well, the film did well, but, I lost the title, and I was very upset about that, yeah.
Yeah, the film did extraordinarily well, but the book did well, too. Did you actually write the book, or did you use a ghostwriter?
Of course not. I wrote the f***ing book. I never use a ghostwriter. No, I wrote it, every f***ing word.
What did you learn about yourself from the process of sitting down and writing it all out?
Well, I realised that I'm pretty good at it, actually. No problem with expressing. No, I seem to be, I always was, even at school, I seem to be able to do that. But it's hard, you know, because it took a couple of years, not like 2 years every day. I mean, I kind of messed around with it for 2 years and it gradually got more and more serious. And then the last bit of it was I devoted about 5 months to it where I just went to my study every day and I put about 5 or 6 hours into it a day until I got it. And then I let a few other people read it, and then I edited it and rewrote some of it until, you know, finally I handed it over. Well, I had an agent in New York, and we sold it, and there's a little bit from the editor, not too much. But it was, you know, a process. I mean, the thing about writing, I certainly learned, was that it's always rewriting, revisioning, you know, and letting things saturate in your head and marinate in your head until you... And suddenly out of nowhere, you get a better way of phrasing something. It's very much like music in that sense.
Yeah. Was it therapeutic as well, like on a spiritual level?
There was a certain amount of catharsis took place, I think, you know, because the one thing I didn't want to write about was the police, of course. I had no interest in writing about the bloody police. Who gives a shit? But actually, you know, of course...
Well, a lot of people do, actually, but still, yeah.
I know. Of course, I got like, as I sort of mentioned it to a few people, I got sort of... You've got to do that. So, you know, that was the difficult part. And the way I did that was, okay, I couldn't even remember so much of it. I had to sort of look at other books and look online and all the rest. And I literally had to set up a sort of a scaffolding. Like, this happened then, this was the first record, this was the second record, then we went to America, then we came back, then we had another number. I sort of kind of outlined, I did a scaffolding of the facts, what actually took place. And I had this all up on the wall, and then I started to write into it, you know, like the emotional side and the inner, you know, the inner life of what really went on. Not because the facts are boring, but that was where I got into it, and there had to be a sort of, I suppose, a methodology.
Yeah.
Which, you know, writing just like anything else, you know, you have to have a sort of a schematic, you know, that goes, okay, this is sort of it. Now let me see if I start writing into it, how it will change. And hopefully, you know, along the way, you get better ideas. You know, things just pop out and they go, oh, I never thought of that. There's a sideways thing here I could talk to.
So in a lot of ways, that was like creating music as well, I suppose.
Absolutely. And it is now because I write now. I was wrote more last night. I have to write. I'm always writing. I'm always being asked to write things. This is like endless. And, you know, part of this show that I'm doing is reading stories. I have many. And I probably put it out as a book. But and what I do, and the story is a fairly surreal, dark comedy story. Just because I try to involve a guitar.
Yeah.
Or music some way, because I think people expect it. But then that's difficult, you know, to do that, you know, to always involve that.
What is the darkest story that you'll be telling in the new show then?
Well, I've got to see how this goes. Like, it's usually about rivalry or, somebody losing somebody else or something being completely f***ed up one way or the other, so they'll never recover.
And funny stories too. So light and shade.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, they're usually fairly bleak black comedy where something's going to go wrong or it's weird or whatever. Yeah, that's what I'm sort of aiming for, to keep the tone throughout. You know, I mean, there's, you know, different people I'm sort of basing them on, you know, like through my own readings, obviously, you know.
Yeah. And so you say you're working on the show right now. How do you prepare for a show like this with it being so different?
Well, I mean, the biggest slog of the whole thing has been downloading so much photography over so many years into coherent sequences.
Yeah.
But, you know, we did it last year at the Grammy Museum and it went down so well without even having had the time to give it much thought. But I thought, well, Christ, if I sort of line this up better and make it flow even better, it's going to be even better. So, I mean, that's really been the most amount of work. It's taken months, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But through the miracle of the digital world, I've been able to do something that I never used to be able to do, which was download all my film contact sheets onto a screen and put them in this search word engine, so I can pull up anything under any title, you know, and form sequences that way. That's what we've done, but it's been a huge amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then if they're in film, I have to take out the negatives and scan it, download it, and rebuild the photograph in a digital file to put it up on the screen. Yeah.
And there's going to be a Q&A section during the show. Are any questions off limits?
Not really.
No. What's the question you dread the most? I think I probably know, but what is the question you dread the most?
Well, mostly, I don't want to really talk about the police, but obviously it's going to be hard to avoid.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is it going to be like, you know, are the police getting back together and going on tour again? Is this something? Yeah, that's got a
boring question. Anyone?
How will you react to that question? Will you turn on the audience and say, you know, ask another question? I'm not interested.
Well, I might. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'll be totally in the moment. You know, you're hanging by a thread when you're doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm dying up here. No, I've done it many times. It usually goes very well. People are usually very sweet.
Yeah.
You know, you have to assume if they're coming to the show, they like you.
Yeah.
And so you just try to get them to like you a bit more. It's not that difficult, you know. You don't have to be an asshole up there. I'm going to give people a good time, you know, hopefully in an exotic way. And then, you know, it gets more personal and you get into a nice sort of chatty thing, and usually it's going pretty well. I'm not the first time I've done this. I've, you know, like last year of 2015, I had a movie out all over the state, so I was turning up here, there, and everywhere, like, and talking to audiences, you know. So I'm hoping for the best here. It's either that or it's over. The whole thing's finished. I'm done.
Well, what do you wish people would ask in a Q&A that they don't tend to ask?
Well, you know, what you would hope for are the more interesting questions about art. How do you make this? How did you, what was you thinking about this? How did you get to that image, or why did you play that there? Where did it come from? You know, and things like that. This is, gets more interesting. Of course, most of those are fairly hard to answer as well, but it's better than what did you have for breakfast?
They don't ask that though, do they?
Well, there's usually somebody who will, you know, throw one at you like that. But, you know, even that, you know, you have to be on the spot and you have to be fast. You have to be creative and, you know, hopefully, I mean, they want to be entertained. You can't get like deadly serious and like, otherwise it's all a bit of a downer. You want it to be clever and witty.
You know,
and you know, you're on hanging by a thread, and hopefully you'll come up with it. I mean, I've done it enough, and I seem to be able to come up with it usually. I mean, I've done 5 million interviews in my life, so it's not something that I'm scared of or anything, you know.
Yeah, it's performance. Yeah,
you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, I've never felt more alive.
Now, you are responsible for so many iconic guitar riffs. Which one are you most proud of?
I think they're all pretty good, actually. Could be Message in a Bottle or Every Breath You Take. Or
yeah.
In the Park, played on Walking on the Moon, I think, you know.
Yeah.
They all hold up very well, actually.
They still do.
Amazing.
Yeah, I do a daily radio show, and they still hold up. You know, I play them all the time. Yeah.
And they don't sound dated.
Not at all.
Who knew at the time? But, I mean, I travel all over the world. I hear the Police all over the world. In every elevator and every hotel, they're still playing them. They sound fresh.
Yeah.
They didn't date. It's kind of amazing.
Is there any that you are fed up with hearing, though? Because they have been played a lot on the radio, especially Every Breath You Take.
Yeah. You know what is interesting about that is that it's always the context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it just depends if I'm in a restaurant in Shanghai or, you know, on a train going from, you know, Munich to Paris, I don't know, and suddenly this thing comes and you go, I never heard it like that before.
Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah, or a party, you know, when other people are there, if other people are there and something comes on, you know, it's bizarre, yeah. I always like these different contexts because it gives you a different look at the music. You go, oh, okay, I get it. I see now. I finally understand why it was a hit. I get it. Personally get it. You know, it's like.
And what is the process? How do you create something from nothing? Where does it start?
Well, I think you have to have a certain amount of trust. You know, when I go to the studio, like for these last two albums, there's nothing written. But, you know, my head is the computer. I've had a lifetime of absorbing, listening, you know, taking it all in, trying to reproduce it on a guitar, trying to figure it all out. That's kind of what I am. And some days are better than others, you know, but I, you know, in my situation, I have a studio. I have a guy who's worked with me for many years. We're used to being together and I sit on the couch. I go, all right, let me plug this guitar in it. Let's try some pedals or something. Let's see what's going on. We start like literally like with nothing and I play for a couple of hours and some stuff will come out and we're wait a minute, that sounds like it might be something. Let's record something. Let's record this. And that's literally how it starts. But I trust the process that takes place in the head. And hopefully the hands and things will, you know, start to emerge. And then you start, you know, hopefully the creativity kicks in and you start to build on this little bit you got. Like I might record 16 bars of a strange sound and go, you know, let me listen to that tomorrow. I come back next day. Yeah, it still sounds good. Let me try and play something over it and let's see if we can find something that might follow it. And this is a process and gradually you get into the zone and it all starts to flow. So I'm very much in favor of that. I mean, same if you just, that's a very free and open process. And if you, the other process is sitting with a guitar, or in my case, usually the guitar, and trying to work out a whole structured piece and writing it all out.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still, you know. And one of the examples I'd like to tell people that's happened to me so many times is, you know, you slog away on the guitar, you know, maybe with a little recorder and you're trying to get something fresh sounding coming. You know, you play for a couple of hours, nothing, you know, and the last minute you just like casually throw, you know, just play something and that's it. You go, oh,
and that's the thing.
That's the thing. And, you know, all the rest was rubbish. And that last little piece was the gem. That's what I was looking for. And that's it. And that's what happens.
But you wouldn't have got to that last piece if you hadn't been through the process.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and you do this enough times in your life, you start to go, well, it'll happen somewhere, you know.
It's just going in and opening the shop, isn't it? Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah. So I don't worry. If I go, oh, God, nothing happened today. Well, I go, don't worry, it'll happen tomorrow, you know.
Yeah.
you know, and there are things that I do, you know, to help, you know, that whatever guitar it is, whatever setup we have, you know. Yeah.
So. And you grew up in Bournemouth, which is an area I know really well, on the south coast of the UK. I presented the breakfast show on the local radio station there a couple of times. Two stints, actually. Whereabouts in Bournemouth did you live?
Well, actually, we lived all over it.
Oh, did you?
My parents moved around a lot. I think we ended up in, I think it's called Charminster.
Charminster, yeah. Well, we lived in Boscombe and we also lived in Westbourne when we were down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know. Well, obviously, I was there as a kid and my sister still lives there. I don't go too often now. I think I went last summer.
You don't fancy buying a nice house at Sandbanks Pool? It's a nice area? Or?
I don't think I can afford it anymore.
I don't think anybody can.
No.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Sandbanks, yeah, what a joke. You know, what a joke, Sandbanks. You know, like untold millions, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, no, I don't really have any desire to go back there. In fact, it's not what it was.
No.
Is it? I mean, when I was a kid there, it was wonderful, like sleepy little old seaside resort, lots of, you know, kids from Europe there, Spanish language schools,
yeah,
all that. Yeah, it was great. It's not like that anymore. They carved it up with the bloody motorways and
yeah,
I don't recognize it actually.
Yeah.
And you know, I last time I was there, I went for about 3 or 4 days and I stayed in, they used to, you know, it used to be total shit if you stayed there in a hotel. Christ, that's grim. Yeah, now they've got a couple of little sort of she boutique hotels. I managed to find one last time. You know, and of course, there's like a Polish girl, or not an English girl, working at the desk. She says, so what do you think of Bournemouth? Isn't it wonderful? I said, boy, you should have seen it in the old days.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no idea.
Yeah.
God, it was so much nicer. Right? It was natural.
Yeah.
That was a while back.
So Santa Monica is where you live these days. Why did you choose that part of the world?
Why did I? I don't know. Maybe because it's a sort of recreation of Bournemouth as it was. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Right by the beach with the cliffs. It's the same. It's like Bournemouth on steroids. It's very nice.
They could use that as a marketing campaign, couldn't they? Yeah.
Well, there you go. Yeah, Bournemouth. Finally, I spent 3 days with it. I'm having a huge photography retrospective early next year in a place called Montpellier,
mm-hmm,
at the Pavillon Populaire. So the curator of the museum has just been here for 3 days. So we had And a wonderful French guy and a total, you know, expert in photography, many books. So we started talking, and he also asked me where I was from in England. I said, oh, Bournemouth. He said, oh, my God, I know Bournemouth so well.
Really?
His grandfather grew up in Bournemouth, and it's the weirdest coincidence, yeah.
Yeah, it's produced some interesting people. Tony Hancock spent a long time there as well. I'm trying to think.
Yeah. I have an affection for it in that part of the world. I love Dorset. And I it's never left me. I mean, I'll probably go back this year at some point and spend a few days. I sort of enjoyed it last year. I've got a million relatives there, you know.
Yeah. And what's the best thing about living in America?
Well, it's getting worse every day, as you know. You know,
is that because of Trump?
Yeah, obviously. You know, I mean, things are hitting a very diabolical. Not sure what's going to go on here. California is like an island; it's on its own, and of course, you know, Trump's trying to sue California, which is incredible. What I'd like to see happen was that California was to secede from the U.S. and be its own place. That would be brilliant. You know, California is wonderful, you know, and you know, we've got the best weather in the world right here. It's very free, very open, very physical. L.A.'s become a fantastic sort of international city. So, you know, it's not English life, but it's a very pleasant and, you know, good place to be. One of the most underrated places in the world, you know.
Yeah, a lot of Brits there. I spoke to Magnus Walker a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you know Magnus.
Yeah.
We talked about his collection of Porsches, and he just absolutely loves living in L.A. He'd never go back to Sheffield, he said, that's for sure.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it is. You know, if you can get into it. I mean, I came in when I was pretty young, and, you know, I've been here a lot, long time now. There are a lot of Brits here, and
John Mayle is someone I've spoken to as well. Just loves living in LA. Yeah,
he's always and a lot, there's a lot. I mean, there's a kind of a groove here that you get into that's so much harder in England. Of course, I love England too, but and I still have my house in London.
Yeah,
so you know, I've still got a foot in the UK, wondering what's happening there too. It doesn't look too good at the moment. But I'm here, you know, with my kids, and you know. But, you know, I don't feel American at all. I'm a guy who lives in English Guide.
Yeah. So what about the press there? I mean, the British press have a bit of a reputation for being intrusive. How do the US press treat you?
Oh, they're much softer. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I felt like I had to leave the UK was I just couldn't stand that tabloid mentality anymore. I just got so sick by it. You know, as you know, it's terrible.
Yeah.
England, horrendous. That's not like that over here, you know. I've never felt that. I felt that the thing, one of the differences, particularly on the West Coast, is that there's so much enthusiasm if you're successful and you've done something, you're trying to do stuff. People always want to talk to you and they basically cheer you on. I mean, that's the sort of simple version of it. But I, you know, the thing in England, as you know, that you're successful, they want to chop you down. It's vicious.
I mean, they really did attack the police at the beginning, and I think that was because we were coming off the back of punk, and the police were just so successful. It had nothing to do with the work, but I think, didn't they have a problem as well that you and Stuart and Sting, to a lesser degree, had come from whatever prog is, but had come from what they were calling a prog background? They had a problem with that as well. I mean,
they have a problem with everything. I was never prog. I was never in a prog band. I don't know what they're talking about, you know.
Yeah, but you did get that though, didn't you?
We got everything. We got all the shit they could throw at us, you know, that's typical of the press. But meanwhile, every record was number one and we were like the biggest band in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the only thing you just end up with, well, you know what, I don't want to stay in this country. None of us did.
Yeah,
we all left.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
like so many people do, can't take it anymore.
Yeah,
you know, it's legal. It's never really changed, and I've never forgotten that. It was definitely a factor in making me not want to be there anymore. It was just, you know, I guess I was used to being in the US all the time then, and being in LA, and you know, being cheered on, everybody loves you, and it's so different than the atmosphere in the UK,
yeah,
which was kind of poisonous to some extent. You know, I've never lost my love for England and English life, and so much about it, and especially the humour. But the tabloid thing is just really terrible. You know,
yeah.
Now Murdoch took over.
Well, when you were the biggest band in the world, it must have made going out in public interesting. What reaction do you get these days when you're out and people recognize you?
Well, it's all context, you know, it's context.
Yeah.
You know, if you appear in some sort of, you know, situation where people are they're more tuned to that, then you're going to get, you know, people come up to you and approach you.
Yeah.
That's the way it is. You know, I could go to the supermarket and just go in and out. I don't get bothered. I mean, sometimes you get stuff like that, but most of the time I live a fairly normal life.
Do they ask for the dreaded selfie?
Oh, yeah. It's the one thing I really hate.
Do you pose for them?
Nah, sometimes I do. A lot of the time I don't like it because, you know, like particularly with this thing I do in Brazil, you know, it's like, you know, lines around the bloody block. And in the old days, somebody would monitor it. You sign an autograph, bye, thank you, very quick, you know, 1, 2, 3. Now they want to stand there, they're trying to get their camera to work, they all want a selfie, and each person takes 5 minutes. It's like, Christ. So you don't have a lot of alternatives except to leave immediately and not meet anybody, or you're going to be there for 3 hours. I mean, it's gotten sort of difficult, you know.
Yeah. I chatted to John Cleese. I went to meet him in Chelsea in his office, and we had a chat there for the show. And he will not pose for selfie. He wouldn't even pose for one with me.
Yeah.
So he's just got zero tolerance. Could you see it getting to that level?
Yeah, really. I mean, because, you know, But, I mean, you know, the same thing, you don't want to like be like this horrible guy. You know, you just played for them, they paid to come and see you. And they, you know, especially in foreign countries, they expect it. I think you have to set it up, you know, like, no selfies. You know, somebody has to be out front saying, no photographs. You sign autographs, give us your autograph book or whatever, or the photo or whatever you want signed, or the record. But no, we're not doing selfies. Because it's just, I mean, literally, well, there's two reasons. It takes too long.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be there all night trying to get through the line. And two, they're always horrible. So, you know, if you have any vanity about your image, you look like shit in a selfie, and then they can put it on the internet.
Because it's so close and it's wide angle. And
it's horrifying.
Andy Summers, it's been great talking to you. Andy Summers, the Harmonics of the Night Tour. It's going to be at the Music Instrument Museum in Phoenix on the 27th of March, then the Regent Theatre, Los Angeles, April 14th, Palace of Fine Arts, San Francisco, April 19th. You'll get more details at andysummers.com. Andy, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yes, great talking to you, Graham. Thank you very much. All the best.
Well, that's it for this one. Back with another one soon, and guests including Kim Wilde, Engelbert Humperdinck, and the urban outlaw Magnus Walker. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. You want to hear more Mac Nuggets? Check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Might call you back. I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.